About the things people love to hate and hate to love, and we're your hosts, Shelby and Matt.
Yes, we're here to talk about tennis.
Yes, our favorite sport and one we know so much about.
Well, we're
Have you ever played?
This is mostly a sports podcast. I actually have played of the sports that I know about. Like, I feel like tennis is probably the sport I know the most about, solely because my grandma used to be she was a tennis coach, and so she sort of taught us how to play, kind of, which I did enjoy. And I have a racket in my apartment that I have been carrying around my entire time in New York, but have never used because it's a nightmare to get court time in New York. Anyways, someday.
Has she seen the movie?
Well, she's dead, so
that would be no. There was a possibility that was the case. I was like, I'm gonna go for it. I'm gonna swing
and a miss.
It's tough. Yeah, it's tough. Oh, my condolences, Matthew.
I mean, it's been a bit.
I hope she got to watch this up in the bright blue, pearly whites.
Yeah, I'm like, would she have liked this movie? She probably would have found it slightly boring and not understood most of it. She was an expert at falling asleep in movies and really needed things that had very little plot going on, because she'd fall asleep and then wake up and forget that she'd fallen asleep, and so would think. So it needed to be something that wasn't confusing and you could sort of zone out for a 30-minute chunk.
This movie works well. It's about a single game, really. I mean, yeah, it's like...
But I think the time, like the jumping back and forth between past and present would not have suited her well.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't think she would have been able to gather the subtleties of like, oh, Zendaya has a bob, now she doesn't, now she has a knee scar. Like, she's not getting that.
Yeah, well, let's pour one out to Matthew's grandmother. May she rest in peace.
But I was going to say that on top of playing tennis and teaching tennis, she also liked to watch tennis a lot. So whenever she would be at our house or we would be staying with her, like if one of the Opens was on, it was basically on all day. And I've been to the U.S. Open and I've toured Wimbledon. The like facilities. So you could say I'm an expert.
When?
When did I tour Wimbledon?
Yeah.
When I went to London, like 2019.
Is that a thing that anyone does? It's just like, oh, take a tour of Wimbledon?
Well, so like Wimbledon is like a very fancy tennis club.
Yeah.
And, you know, on top of having the tournament, and it's on grass. And so it was me and my mom and my brother, and we mostly went there because we were going to get something for my grandma, you know, like, oh, we'll like bring her back a souvenir. Yeah. And it's sort of outside of London. So you can take a train there. It's pretty easy to get to. But then when I was looking it up, it's like, oh, they have a tour of the facilities. And so we went on that, and it was really interesting because you get to see like the press box and the locker rooms and the courts and stuff, but because it's grass, like nobody really plays on it all year, and there's all of these like special things that they do and ways that they trim it and make sure that the grass is like perfect for when it actually comes time to play the tournament. So yeah, it was a very interesting tour, I would say, and if you like tennis, worth doing. And then the U.S. Open is in New York, so that's easy to get
to.
I have not been to the Australian Open, and I was in Paris and could have gone to like tour the French Open place, but I was also there in the middle of winter, so I did not go.
Have you been to the New Rochelle Challengers?
No, but I was looking this up because I was like, okay, so like, I don't know if this is too early to get into this, but like, the Challengers is set in New Rochelle, specifically in 2019. And specifically there is like a giant windstorm, like hurricane
almanac, and you're like, no.
Well, I was, so I was, con- like, because That's sort of just a random plot point in the movie. Yeah. Like they could have been anywhere. They picked New Rochelle. Okay, great. But I was like, was there a windstorm that was during, like, is this a real tournament? What, like, but I don't think this is a real match.
Yeah.
And well, it's obviously not based on a true story, but it's like, I could not find the, like, New Rochelle Challenger meet. Like, this is not a real event that I am aware of. And I was also looking to see if, like, oh, this windstorm was the reason why they set it there or something, because it does, like, kind of play into the plot or no, but I also couldn't find anything related to that. So I think they just made up this random windstorm for seemingly no reason in the middle of the film.
Well, it's not for no reason. It's called symbolism. It's called a scene, emotional scene setting. I mean, it matters.
But, like, what even is a windstorm? Like, it's not a tornado and it's not a hurricane.
What even is a windstorm? Like
have you ever been,
like, weather patterns? Like, what is it?
Like, I don't know. I have never been someplace where it's like there is a quote unquote, like, windstorm. It's like hurricane winds, but there's no hurricane or tornado. It's just, like, really windy.
There's ripple effects, right? So if there is a hurricane in Florida, then there's a windstorm in Alabama, you know. It's like,
so we think that there was, like, Hurricane Sandy was, like, hitting or whatever, and that's why this was windy the one night before the Challengers.
I think that
would have
been a little bit too close, but it's also, like, I mean, yeah, you get, like, wind storms. Like, it gets windy in California, it gets windy in New York. Like, I feel like this happened, like, this year, where everyone on TikTok was, like, recording themselves being blown away, or they're, like, buses swerving on the roads because of strong winds. Like, this is a thing that happens. It's wind. It's I can't tell you the machinations wind winding, but it does in fact wind.
I just the real life details that were in this movie I found very interesting because they're not like based on real life. And no, I have not been to New Rochelle. There is apparently a country club there.
But I just picture you sitting in the theater with your little notebook and you're just scribbling, like, windstorm New York, verify. Like,
well, I thought it was a weird detail to not be real, and also, like, to set the movie in 2019. Like, I guess they wanted to dodge, like, COVID or whatever, but I feel like that's a very specific time to set a movie that's, like, not that long ago but not that close, you know what I mean?
Yeah
like, it didn't film in 2019.
This is interesting. It's like things that didn't phase me at all. Like, I think it's just, like, I think it works backwards to have them be so young but not have their lives affected by, like, recent events, you know what I mean? Like, so it's like
we didn't want to have a plot line that's like, oh, they had to take 3 years off because of COVID or whatever.
Yeah, or they're not, like, having to make TikToks, or it's like, I don't remember what year they would have been going to college, but, like, the lack of personal contact, like cell phones or Facebook or, you know, like, the social media game was different. So they weren't aware of Tashi in the same way that they might have been had they been super online.
Yeah. No, I get that. There were just weird.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, like, maybe
none of these are negative things. Like, I wasn't like windstorm, like, docking points for this. I was just the movie was so specific that I was like, oh, this feels like it has to be a real thing. And then it was like, no, they just sort of made it up arbitrarily.
Yeah, like, I was wondering, like, oh, when did Uniqlo start sponsoring sport athletes? You know, like. Was Uniqlo a big deal in 2019, or was that a choice in today to make a big buck?
Are you making fun of me?
Uniqlo in this film? No. I mean, tangentially, you know, secondary maybe, but it was a thought I had. I was like, oh, Uniqlo. They're getting their name out there.
Oh, yeah. Well, because On Running was also prominently featured, and I feel like that's also a newer brand.
Cute.
So, yeah, this movie had so much product placement.
It felt like more natural product placement, but it was like curiosity.
So many beverages, obviously so many sports brands, but it was sort of interesting because you would, I guess, assume that like one sports brand would have sponsored, or like that, you know how with famous athletes, they have some sort of deal with like a certain brand and they only wear that. But like there was a lot of different athletic brands. There were car ads. There was a prolonged scene involving a Dunkin' Donuts sandwich. There was a lot of, like, they were really bringing in the money with the product placement.
Yeah, they were corporate synergy to the max. I mean, good for them. Now I'm just Googling, when did Uniqlo become a big deal? I don't know.
Uniqlo was a big deal when I... like moved to New York. I feel like people like Uniqlo was a thing then.
Right,
so that
right.
would have been before 2019.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I'm watching I'm watching my way through Sex and the City. This is a side plot. And I just watched this whole episode where Miranda is like quote unquote in love with TiVo. And there's like an extended sequence sort of that maps out like how TiVo works and how she uses it to watch shows that she likes. And I'm like, how did this get its way into an episode? Like, obviously there was a, like, this was a corporate sponsor thing, but like, did somebody say, hey, we want an episode like that involves watching a lot of TV and let's just have like, and then reached out to TiVo, or was TiVo like, hey, we would love an episode. We'll give you $1 million if you can write us in a plot line. And they were like, sure, we'll give it to Miranda.
Yeah, I think you have to pitch like a oral history of that to Parade and just start interviewing the cast and crew to see how that happened.
Of the oral history of the TiVo episode? Okay, I'll get on it. I'll reach out to Sarah Jessica Parker. Hey, do you happen to know?
Do you remember?
I'm like, because I don't think TiVo was even a thing anymore. Like, I would be reaching out to like old marketing executives at TiVo.
Exactly. It scratches the thirst for nostalgia, but it also brings us back to advertising in the modern media landscape. I think there's something there for sure.
This is how I get my Pulitzer,
you know, as a resident journalist,
doing the deep dive into the TiVo marketing campaigns of 2003.
But no, I circling back,
tennis,
I don't
movie.
Know anything about tennis. Yeah.
Okay, so you don't know anything about tennis.
I don't know anything about tennis. I mean, I've played casually with Rob once or twice in our lives. I think I've never, ever watched a match. Like, I've seen, you know, I saw the Venus and Serena movie, the
King Richard.
King Richard. And I've seen clips of them, usually the internet being mad they got upset or something. But yeah, it's never really been, you know, sports and me.
Were you confused at all then about like how the match worked?
I think it's pretty straightforward.
Okay. Well, because I feel like tennis scoring is really weird. So I didn't know if you.
Yeah, but
like,
it's
especially at the end,
you know,
when it's advantage and deuce and stuff.
I think basketball scoring is really confusing. Football scoring is really confusing. You just kind of realize that there's a group of people handling a ball. And you're rooting for them to do one specific thing with that ball. And in tennis, it's just, oh, don't let them hit it back to you, you know? And so I think it becomes fairly easy.
Yes, I do know that about tennis. But I'm talking about, like, this game, set, match, the, like, love, advantage, so-and-so, deuce. The fact that there's, like, match points, but then later on, like, it's not a match point again.
You know, I have seen... Wimbledon, starring Kirsten Dunst, and seen Wii Tennis. I've played that.
So there you go.
I should have mentioned that.
I'm like, if you've played Mario Tennis or whatever, then you know how it works.
Yeah, and Rob has yelled at me to say, no, it's love. It's love. And I'm like, what are you guys? Okay, congrats.
40 love.
I'll use your little language, okay, so you feel special.
I think it's French. Somehow.
I don't know. But no, it didn't. I was like, I was completely happy to sit in this movie, and I don't feel like I was taken out of it. In fact, I feel like maybe I think with movies like this, people are like hypersensitive to like, oh, it's so clear she's not playing, or like she wouldn't be that good, or like, you know, criticizing every single serve or technique or whatnot. And I didn't have any of that baggage because, like I said, IDGAF. But it was a great time. I had a lot of fun with this movie. It's very sexy, very horny.
Yeah, I really loved this. I felt like it was, like, in some ways it was kind of Saltburn-y in that it had these sort of viral moments already going around the internet, and it was very horny, but it also felt a lot more, like, there was a lot more meat on the bone, I think, than Saltburn was. Like, on the surface, Challengers is kind of like, oh, it's a horny bisexual, like, threesome movie, but really... I think there's a lot more going on, and it's a lot more substantial than that with creating these three characters and sort of moving them through time. And yeah, it's all set around this one match in New Rochelle, but then you keep cutting back to previous them and sort of like moving through history towards this match. And I thought that that really worked well, because initially you're like, okay, these two people are playing tennis, but like, why does this matter? And then as you get closer and closer, you're like, oh, there is a lot going on right here on this tennis court. Yeah. This is years worth of pent up drama between the three of them. And I was like, this is masterful. Like, the whole thing just was chef's kiss.
Yeah, it was fun because it was like, as it started, you got a big chunk of the game, then you got a big chunk of their first meeting, then you got a big chunk of their, like, you know, sort of midpoint, and the flashbacks or whatnot felt a lot longer and substantial. But then as the game amped up, the flashbacks amped up, and it got more and more like hyper in its you know, back and forth, shall we say. And so it started to match the energy of the game, where to the point where it's like, oh, does he know what happened in Atlanta? Boom, you're back in Atlanta. Like, it's not really, obviously it's not chronological, but even the flashbacks aren't chronological. Sometimes they go back, oh, 8 days ago. Sometimes they go back to the starting point of, like, what would it have been, like 2004 or whatever?
Whenever
it started.
Amateurs.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like all over the place. And at first I was sort of like, oh, it's weird that they didn't just do like one flashback, boom, 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 clean it up, boom, boom, boom. But by the end of it, you understand like, oh, the essence of these flashbacks is sort of the frenetic, kind of hyperactive emotional volleys of the game, but then their lives and this sort of intertwining as it crescendos and climaxes, shall we say. And so the format of the film actually lends itself to the story at play too.
Yeah, I think we maybe talked about this when we talked about Tar, and how like the beginning of that starts with really long scenes, and then sort of like as you go along the scenes get quicker. And it builds up the momentum, which I didn't even really think about, but it is getting a lot more rapid fire as you get towards the end. I guess to sort of set up the plot of this a little bit, there's Zendaya. The character names in this movie are just so good, too. Like, Zendaya's character is Tashi Duncan, and I feel like I never remember characters' names, and it's like Tashi Duncan will be ingrained in my brain for forever.
You're getting it tattooed this weekend, I know.
But she's sort of like a hotshot rising star tennis player. She wins the US Open Juniors. And at that same tournament, the Josh O'Connor character, his name is Patrick Zweig, and the Mike Feist character, Art Donaldson, are also competing. But they're like best friends. They win doubles, and then they're competing against each other on the finals. And the night before all of this happens, they both sort of have a crush on Zendaya. They invite her back to their hotel room. There's this like hot sort of makeout scene between the three of them. And she's like, I'll date whichever of the two of you wins the match the next day. And Josh O'Connor's character wins. And so she starts dating him. But in the present day, she is married to Mike Feist and is his coach because she had an injury in college. And so now like he's sort of carrying on the tennis dream for both of them. And they're in this sort of rinky-dink tournament in New Rochelle to try to like build up his confidence before the U.S. Open, and then he happens to face off against his ex-best friend slash Zendaya's ex-boyfriend, Josh O'Connor. And through a series of flashbacks, we learn all kinds of tumultuous things about the relationship and how they, you know, screwed each other over at various points, and the things that they want and need out of the other people, and this love triangle. And yeah, it's just, it's such a well-written movie, I think. Which, yeah. So this is a part that I wanted to talk about. This movie was written by Justin Kurtzkiz, who is the boyfriend of Celine Song, who wrote and directed Past Lives last year. And both Past Lives and this movie are about like romantic sort of threesomes where there's like a couple and then like another guy who sort of like comes in and screws things up, sort of. And I'm like, what is going on in this relationship?
I don't see the similarities.
You don't?
I mean, Past Lives is a childhood crush slash romance. Then she gets married to someone totally unrelated to that and has moved on with her life totally unrelated to him. And then they sort of reunite and she has to figure out if it was worth it or if this loss like hurts too much.
Yes, but both of the movies are basically about like a prolonged romance set over many years that involves like three romantic characters.
True, Twilight too, you know, like it's like, well, that's,
yeah,
just
no. Yes, but I'm just saying, like, I think it's interesting that both people in this like long-term relationship are writing like very successful hit scripts like at the same time that are sort of about like something similar, and I'm like, did something happen to them? Like, was there a third person involved at some point, or did they both just sort of dream up this?
A couple times, like people were like, "Oh, look at this connection." To me, it's like, I don't see it. I think that's the least interesting. Sorry,
I mean,
not dragging you. It just seems like the least compelling piece of this like storytelling. Like, I mean, I think there's such distinct stories and characters that it's sort of like, I don't feel like digging into it like it's a Taylor Swift song is really serving either of the movies, you know?
No, I don't think that these movies are like hiding some random thing. And obviously they're very different versions of this like love triangle. So I don't think that like, oh, you know, one of these is like based on something that actually happened necessarily. I just think that it's interesting that two people who are presumably like spending a lot of time with each other, like reading each other's scripts, like are very involved in each other's lives, like come up with two, I think, really incredible movies that are sort of like kind of about a similar thing. And it does make you wonder if like there wasn't something that happened with like, because
so
I just
are, yeah,
well, no, but it's like, I just, not that the movies are about that, but I feel like they're both about these like love triangles in such like clear, specific, like well drawn out ways that I'm like, I wonder if there was something that happened that sort of like inspired these at some point. Get into it, but I do. But it's not like, oh, they're both filmmakers and one of them is writing rom-coms and one of them is writing like action movies or something.
I mean, one is writing like a slow paced, like Oscar Beatty film, and one's writing like a reminiscent of the 90s, like sex thriller, you know? So it's like they're very different.
But I think this is a lot more than a sex thriller.
I think it's like,
I feel like this is a lot more character driven than people are giving it credit for.
Oh, of course it's character driven, but it's character driven in the same way, like Basic Instinct is, or Fatal Attraction. Like, it's obviously a little bit more heightened because of the performances and the directing and the fact that it's such like three fully drawn characters. But at the, you know, it's, I, I'm not trying to diminish challengers. I'm just saying there's such different genres to me, with different sensibilities. And like, I think the triangle at the heart of challengers is like the framework. Like it's, they're so entangled that that becomes the whole thing. Where in past lives, it's still very much about the main character and her sort of like, you know, sliding doors moment of like regret and choice and love and nostalgia and whatnot. So that's still a very like single person action. Whereas this is like a tangled web of toxicity.
Well, yeah. And in past lives, it's like, the Greta Lee character is sort of like picking between the two men, but the two men like really aren't involved with each other other than like a couple of scenes. Where in this, I think that while the two men are in love with Zendaya, they're also like sort of in love with each other and like are really close friends, but there's also like definitely some sexual chemistry there. And at one point in the movie, the Josh O'Connor character is like on a dating app and is swiping for men and women. So you're like, okay,
there's
bisexual element.
I think that dynamic is like the most fascinating because the first you see is Art and wow, what's his name?
Patrick.
And so you're immediately like watching them like, well, I mean, this is in the flashback, but like Patrick is basically like, yeah, I'm going to be done with tennis, so I'll throw the match for you and like you can keep doing this. I don't really care type thing. But then as soon as there's this shared interest for Zendaya's character, who's very like hot, and Patrick is drawn to her because she's hot, and Art becomes drawn to her because she's not in a better way, but like she's hot and talented. Like he's much more aware of her game. And you can see like in the subtleties, the way Patrick is obsessed with seeing how Art is obsessed with Tashi. Like even when they're looking at the posters of her, he eventually starts looking at Art looking at her. And I think that becomes sort of this interesting through line that I've seen, which is that Patrick loves Art, Art loves Tashi, and Tashi loves tennis. Which is sort of a simplistic rundown of the movie, but I think is important in the dynamic at play there, because it's always Patrick who's being like, he's pulling Art's chair closer. He's sharing his churro. He's like clearly enamored with Art, but uses Zendaya somehow as a vehicle for that at times, which I find so fascinating. But there is like this homoeroticism, because it's like their hotel beds are already pushed together, they're constantly like, you know, hugging, and they're very touchy-feely friends, and they're talking about like how they masturbated together as boys. Like I think that is such a fascinating point, and how it doesn't mean as much to Art as it seems to mean to Patrick.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and also like that angle is really interesting, but then also all of their relationships to tennis and how that is intertwined is fascinating too, because like Patrick is very talented but doesn't sort of have the like motivation or the drive, and Art has like the precision and the motivation but doesn't necessarily have the talent, and then Tashi had the talent but now is injured, and so is sort of having to like channel that through the boys, because she coaches like each of them at one point, and almost like her attraction to them is solely because they play tennis and they can sort of like be this vehicle or vessel for her talent that she never got to use because she got injured. Like it's so fascinating watching the three of them like fall in and out of love with each other, but aside from, it's like they never, like none of them are really like falling in love with each other just for the person. There's like all of this weighted meaning behind it with the game, and you know, then their relationships with each other as well.
Well, Tashi makes a point of like literally never saying I love you to either guy. Like, in fact, in Stanford, she's like, what makes you think I need someone to love me? And then in the future, when she's married to Art, he's like, I love you. And she's like, I know. And he asks her, like, if I leave the game, would you leave me? And she's like, you know, kind of flippantly, like, yes, I would. Is that what you want me to say type thing? So there's clearly this, like, withholding of vulnerability from Tashi. And I think that in itself makes a really interesting character. And people want to write her off as, like, the villain of the story. But I found them all so interesting for different reasons, and I'm curious, like, what your first reaction was to Tashi, because I feel like she's become sort of the like the hot button reading in this film, where everyone has a different idea of her, and obviously, like, the dialogue around the movie might have shifted that. But, like, as you left the theater, what was your takeaway?
I mean, I really liked all three of them. And I felt like all three of them were sort of given equal amounts of, like, positive and negative traits. I felt that they were all realistic. Like, when I left the theater, I was very impressed by how, like, all of them seemed very realistic and had very, like, negative qualities, but also very positive qualities in a way that I think we don't often see with movies. You'll probably disagree with this, but I think that one of the movies that I think of when I think of, like, this kind of dynamic is 500 Days of Summer, which I feel like is a movie where you can, like, people have watched it. Like, I think especially initially, people were like, oh, like, she is such a nightmare. Like, he is a good person and she is, like, driving him crazy and is, you know, this, like, manic pixie dream girl. But then I think we relitigated it and we're like, wait, no, actually she is fine. She's just living her life and he is, like, obsessive and crazy and he's the bad guy. And I think ultimately I've sort of settled on, like, oh, they're, like, they're both good and they're both bad at the same time. And that's how a lot of relationships just are. But, you know, society, we want to, like, pick a winner and pick a loser. Especially if the characters on the screen, like, relate to you as a person. I did think with Challengers, I wished that there was maybe a little bit more Zendaya, because I feel like of the three of them, she's, and maybe it's just that, like, in the present day game sequences, you know, she's, like, watching, not playing, but it felt like it was more of the boys' movie than hers, even though she's sort of, like, the bigger star in some ways. I feel like especially in the, like, the end sequences, I kind of, like, wanted a little bit more of her involvement. But I also think that part of her character is that she wants more involvement and she can't because she can't play tennis. So there's that restraint that also sort of works,
like,
with the story.
Holding, like, how much she... Well, I think that's interesting too, because I feel like the flashbacks serve to show how much in control Tashi was. So even as she was just sitting there watching the game, it's like you're watching her strings at work type thing, where she wasn't the one on the court, but she had been the instigator to get them there, for better or worse. And I think the unpacking of her motivations or her intentions is kind of what was fascinating, because I kind of left this movie thinking, like, obviously, she didn't know how it would play out, but I think she got exactly what she wanted in the end, which was using these two boys, you know, her little white boys, to make the game fulfilling for her. And she hasn't been allowed on the court. She can't play anymore. She lost that. And there was this determination, like, to never fall apart and instead use what skills or tools she had in front of her. And that was toying with these two dudes' hearts. And so I don't know if that means that she cheated with Patrick in order to make Art jealous, in order to make him care, in order to get him to the open. Like, I don't know if we'll ever, if they ever, like, intended to lay it out that clearly. But I think there was gameplay happening for her behind the scenes, because that's the only thing she could control. And I think that made her, like, such a fascinating character. And so, like, seeing some of the commentary be like, oh, she's the villain, just seems so, like, derivative and kind of, like, shallow-minded because, one, they're all toxic, but two, she's just working with what she's got, you know, like...
Well, she's definitely the mastermind because the other two are, and she's like the gamer. She's the one who loves games and loves playing. And so the other two are definitely much more like emotional and tied up in the relationships. And she is the one who, like, she talks about how she wants good tennis. Like, that's what she cares about. And that's what she wants. And she's willing to kind of do whatever she needs to get there. One thing that I really loved about the ending of this movie is that you kind of think going through the whole thing, especially because it's a tennis match, that this is going to end with one person beating the other person, or, you know, like somebody's going to be a winner and somebody's going to be a loser. But the script is so genius that it's sort of when it finishes, like everybody kind of gets what they want.
Yeah.
It's like circled back around because Tashi gets to watch good tennis, and that's why she, you know, jumps up and screams at the end. And Art finally like gets his mojo back and like beats Patrick, which he's wanted to do forever, and sort of like proves himself. And
Undecided.
I mean, he like hits. I think he does. But then he also, like, in beating him, he sort of, like, falls over the net, like, into Art or into Patrick's arms. And Patrick is, you know, and it feels like Patrick that maybe Art, they've, like, worked through the bitterness between them. And, like, now they can go back to being friends or, you know, be in each other's lives to a certain extent. And I really just loved that oh, we got an ending that's like happy for everybody, but in a different way. I was
Well, I think it's like, they don't show you who got the winning point. And they've said, like, the director and Zendaya and the cast have said that's intentional. And like, it's like open to interpretation. And like, that's the joy of the movie, is you can go back and you're understanding different things, rooting for different things. But yeah, I think it's telling that Patrick, in his moments where he's most like enamored by Art, it's when he's like, oh, you finally, like, I like to see a little fire in you. And he says that when Art is trying to like sow some dissension in his relationship with Tashi. And then you see it in the smirk when he admits, when he gives a clue to Art during the final match that he slept with Tashi. And that's like, there's like this beat where Art has to decide if he's going to like walk out or if this is going to fire him up, and he like lets it fire him up again. And so it's not necessarily that they're doing good things or like even fighting for good reasons, but I think it's such an interesting human dynamic between the three of them that like the finale feels so like such a release and such a, I don't know, kind of climactic, because it's just like, oh, okay, like this is like what they were working towards in the worst ways possible. But like, you get it, like Tashi, that like a good game is a good game, you know? So yeah, it's like, this is justifiable. Maybe it's did exactly what she needed to.
It's very cathartic in the end. Yeah. You're like, oh, okay, like I'm really like, this is really the release I needed.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's what makes Tashi such a fascinating character. And, you know, it all comes down to this, like, you know, like all the, like this idea that, oh, Tashi ain't shit. Like that was a famous promo interview where one of the interviewees was like, I left hating you, basically. And I just think that's so like lazy, because one, these dudes are just as like, you know, evil and conniving and selfish and, self-absorbed and all of it. So to like hyper fixate on like what this young black woman is like coming across as, is she likable, is she too like controlling, is she cruel, like all of this language is just allowing our society to kind of prove and hopefully pull into question like our obsession with casting women as either like angels or whores type thing, and kind of splitting apart the idea that women can be complicated characters too, because she gets to play with these guys who are not likable. Like Art is a snake and Patrick is kind of this hot mess, and they're all like bringing out the worst in each other but also kind of the best. So I found that interesting to allow this woman to be at the heart of that, not just as a love interest or a thing for these guys to duel over. I feel like she has a really rich character, and her frustration always comes down to what she lost and how she's still going to find fulfillment at whatever cost it takes on those around her.
Yeah, the character development is just so good in this movie. And I thought, like, there is a way to see, I guess, Taji as sort of the most heartless, in that the other two, I think, are, like, do really, like, they are in love with her, and you sort of get the sense that she, like, probably would never have given either of them necessarily, like, the time of day unless they were, you know, I mean, like, she's dating Patrick in college, but, like, sort of seems like she doesn't really care that much. And then once she breaks her leg and can't do anything, she's like, wait, I can actually use these people. And so it is more of like a...
Well, I think she cares about Patrick, because that's why she gets so hurt when he tries to, like, limit their engagement, right? Like, because he's like, I don't want to talk about tennis with you. And she's like, well, what the hell am I going to talk about except tennis? Like, that's what mattered most to her. And so that's sort of like closed the door for her, I felt like. And then their fight in the dorm room where she's like, oh, you're not a member of my fan club. Like, I think it was, they both thought the others had different needs, but like at the heart of it, it was just she needed someone to accept her, and most everything about her was her love of the game.
Yeah, I mean, she's so like stony in,
yeah,
like letting people in. But yeah, no, I think it was almost like, I just think it's so rare that we get a movie that has like one super well drawn out character, let alone three. Yeah. And like, none of them are caricatures, none of them are stereotypes, they're like very specific people. Which was,
well,
which,
and
is,
that's also what's interesting about putting Zendaya as the lead as a Black woman. I think this movie wouldn't have played as well if it was just a white woman, because I think part of Tashi's motivation that's mentioned a couple times is that she doesn't come from the wealth that these two white boys did, and tennis usually is a very wealth-driven sport. And so she had, like, they make some sort of comment about like, oh, she's gonna like give this to her family, like the wealth and the houses and the lifestyle. And so that to then see her wearing the like designer shoes and staying in these gorgeous hotel suites just because her kid likes hotels, like, I think that was a compelling addition to her character, and kind of again showing like how she wasn't allowed to like just be sad and depressed and like give up all her dreams because she had the injury. Like, when she realizes she can't play anymore, she's not like weeping in a field gnashing her teeth. She kind of like has her moment, puts herself together, and immediately like pivots while still being as close to the game as she can be by being a coach and, you know, trying to like push the people around her to care about this as much as she does because of the reason she cares about it.
Well, and she's the one who also like wants to go to college and not become a pro because, yeah, she wants sort of like a backup option for herself. There's definitely some interesting things going on here about like class and wealth. Yeah. And I feel like the first time I didn't catch them all because that's not necessarily the focus of the movie. It's sort of right. Like they're like mentioned in asides and stuff. But I want to watch it again and sort of like pick up on that more now that I know who's who and sort of what's going on. So I want to talk about Luca Guadagnino, who's the director of this movie.
Yeah.
He previously did Call Me By Your Name, which obviously was nominated for a bunch of Oscars. And then more recently he did Suspiria, the remake, and the Bones and All Timothée Chalamet cannibal movie a couple years ago. All of those movies I feel like are a little bit like, to me, like they're varying degrees of not great, but I loved this. And I think a lot of that is because of the screenplay music. Being so strong. Oh. Well, yes. But also, I was going to say, I think that because, like, I think Luca Guadagnino is somebody who sort of gets, like, carried away very easily and is, you know, kind of... he's like this gay Italian man and will sort of just like do random stuff, which I don't necessarily think helps his movies. But I think that he sort of stumbled into something that worked really well with the tennis aspect, because then the script is so good and it keeps everybody so on point, and the actors are obviously incredible as well, that the sort of character driven parts are pretty straightforward. And then for these tennis sequences, he can do kind of whatever he wants and use like weird camera angles and, you know, this crazy score and all kinds of bizarre things. But somehow that really works, I think, for the tennis and makes it like fun and exciting and gives the movie an added like artistic flair that it probably wouldn't have if it was just normal tennis shots, but at the same time allows the character parts of the movie and the off-court scenes to be much more straightforward and not sort of get into the weirdness of some of his other movies.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I think I have issues with the Call Me By Your Name, like, overall story. But I do think it's like a gorgeously and sort of subtly rendered film, like character study. And you can see that at play here, but this is just a lot more juicy, a lot more sweaty, so to say. And so he does get to like play a little bit more, I think. And I can see how that works better here than in some of his more serious subjects. Because that was like the fun part is like, you know, at one point you become the POV of the tennis ball. There's like a, you know, a translucent court, like looking up at them. Like I didn't find that distracting. I felt like it added to the energy. I felt like it was fun and reminded you to just kind of enjoy the game, so to speak. Like it didn't have to be all serious and buttoned up, because it's a very like, you know, heart racing sport, even when it's so buttoned up. And so I think it kind of added to the character of the film, that and the soundtrack, which is absolutely a blast.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you like the score or not? It's Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who have done like, they've won a couple of Oscars, but they did The Social Network and a bunch of other things.
Yeah, I love it.
but I feel like some people are like, what is this score? It's like rave music. Why is it playing? And I'm just like, oh my gosh, like give it to me. Like the more I've been listening to it constantly, it's so like boppy. I'm like, we got to play this in the club. Like I'm ready to be out and listening to this. Give it to me.
It's so fun. It's so like 80s synth pop. And it's like,
it's like a video game score.
Yeah. It just is like, it's very reminiscent of like those sort of pulpy films, but also like adds again to each of the characters. Like there's one through line that only happens when they're on the court playing. And it's just like such high energy that you're like, you know, it's it's bringing the club to the floor, so to speak.
Okay. So then I feel like the last thing we need to talk about is the fact that this movie was originally supposed to premiere at Venice last year and come out last fall, presumably making it an Oscar play. Mm. Now it's coming out in April. We have a long ways before we get to any of the awards season. They moved it because they wanted Zendaya to do press, which I feel like was ultimately a good decision given how much press she has been doing for this movie and her incredible tennis themed outfits.
Yes.
But like, do you think that this movie would have gotten Oscars last year? And or do you think that this will be in the conversation come next you know, winter? Like, do you think it's going to be that this and Dune will both last that long? Presumably Dune will get a bunch of nominations.
I think that this film is both very subtle and very loud, and neither of those tend to work for the Oscars. Like, I think the performances here are strong, but it's a lot of smirks, it's a lot of stony glances, it's a lot of like folded arms. And I don't know if that's something the Oscars tend to appreciate, but I do see this like landing, you know, best score or like a best screenplay nod. I just don't think the performances or direction will be like memorable by the end of the year.
What do you think about maybe Zendaya getting in for one of these movies as sort of like a, well, she was great in two of the big movies this year.
Like, which one do I think is more likely?
Yeah.
I think Dune. I think Dune's a more artistically, I mean, it's, I think it's just a more, you know, standard epic that resonates with a lot of people. Whereas this is like, you know, Gen Z-y, like, oh, it's just like Saltburn type thing. Like, oh, like yeah. A lot of people have missed the point or kind of like water, you know, shrug it off as just like, oh, it's a sexy movie, like whatever, mid-budget, whatever type thing.
Well, Zendaya is also a producer on this, so she could get the Margot Robbie Oscar nomination.
Love that for her.
All these actors just being producers now. Get that money.
They've got to. You know, it's hard times for all of us. So, I mean, I think it is interesting to see Zendaya sort of like having to earn her notoriety in reverse, because like she was such a huge star, but no one could really explain why per se. And now she's getting the more serious, like respected, quote unquote, roles under her belt. So people can finally stop being like, ugh, she's just from Spider-Man.
I did laugh
at that Spider-Verse reference, though. That was like a little bit too on the nose for me.
I know, that was funny. More product placement. I do love that Zendaya is also now like, I guess it's maybe a battle between her and Kim Kardashian for who is the most famous person to compete on Dancing with the Stars. And like, it's fun.
She's just so little. And then like her, I feel like it exploded very quickly. Obviously, at this point, it's been like, I don't even know when the first Star Wars movie came out. But like, it feels like she got so big so fast.
She was in Star Wars?
No, sorry. Spider-Man. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Spider-Man. Well, I feel like it was Euphoria. Or was Euphoria after Spider-Man?
Was it after? I thought she was in the
Or maybe it was before. I don't know. Because she was a Disney Channel star, basically. Oh, yeah. And then at some point, she got Spider-Man and Euphoria. Yeah, and I feel like that's what launched her. But I don't know which one she got
someone
first.
Someone pointed out that every Spider-Man MJ has gone on to do a tennis movie, which is funny. I mean,
yes, you know. I saw that too.
It's like, I'm sure that a lot of people have done tennis movies, but like Wimbledon and Battle of the Sexes and now Challengers, okay. Which is superior.
Spider-Man Homecoming, which was her first like actual movie, was 2017, and Euphoria didn't come out until 2019. But like before 2017, it's like she was in an episode of Blackish. Television show or like a DCOM movie. What was her Shake It Up, I guess, was the TV show that she had. She was on a crossover episode of Good Luck Charlie. Yeah. And like Dancing with the Stars in 2013, where she was a runner up. What is KC Undercover? Oh, that's another Disney Channel show.
Yeah. It's very strange. I mean, I feel like it was I honestly think it comes down to the Spider-Man lip sync battle, you know, when that was like the flash, that was like when she exploded. I mean, it was because of Tom Holland doing Rihanna, but Zendaya was there, you know.
Wait, I feel like we're missing a huge thing, which is that the same year she had Spider-Man Homecoming, she also had The Greatest Showman.
Oh, yeah. I love Greatest Showman.
Which everybody loves.
I mean, yeah, except critics. But yes, I agree. I mean, that's the thing, is it's like, I feel like, yeah, it's a weird thing because it wasn't like a specific role per se that like made her a star. It was just her energy and her fashion and her character. And like, I don't know. It's just like, I mean, she's gorgeous too, so that doesn't hurt. But, you know, usually it's like, Cameron Diaz or Margot Robbie have these like breakout movies that make them movie stars. But it was like Zendaya became a star and then starred in movies.
Yeah.
Like this is like her first real lead.
Yeah.
Unless you count like Dune, but She wasn't in the first one much.
Malcolm and Marie.
Oh, yeah.
Terrible. We try to forget.
We forget that one.
Challengers. Good movie. Glad we saw it. Next week, we'll be talking about The Fall Guy.
Cute.
Which...
Well, you want to do a double feature.
Oh, yes. Wait, what was the other movie we were going to talk about?
The
Anne Hathaway. The Idea of You.
Yeah.
Two rom-coms, really.
Oh, perfect. Okay, thematic. Yeah.
Next week, rom-com week at the theater.
Yeah. Gorgeous. Love it. Can't wait.
I might even bring up Anyone But You again just to talk about how bad it was in comparison.
I did watch that. Just started streaming on Netflix, so I think a lot of people have now seen it.
Did you hate it?
I didn't hate it, but it wasn't good. Like, I was surprised by how little chemistry they had.
Yeah, she's not bless good in just, like, regular roles.
And how you felt about the windstorm in this movie, I was like, I don't understand the geography of this Sydney experience.
Because I also felt that.
And suddenly she's in downtown, and I'm like, wait.
Well, and also the who can swim and who can't swim, and it's like, wait, that's confusing. Also, the whole, like, did they sleep together the first night? I mean, even just that opening scene where it's like her, like, spilling coffee on herself or whatever, and then getting, it's like nothing makes sense.
Yeah.
But anyways, we'll be talking about that next week. Not quite back to regular schedule yet, but hopefully, like, sometime, maybe in June, we'll be back.
There's so much I need to tell you in my love it's. Like, I feel like you need to watch Shogun, you need to watch Fallout, you need to.
I can't. I'm just watching Sex and the City. That's all I'm watching.
Okay.
I'm on season 6. Do you know how impressive that is for me?
It's very impressive.
Well, okay. Thanks everyone for listening, and we will be back again next week. Bye.